Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to welcome back to the program today Alan First. Hello, Alan.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Alan, you've written another book, and I look forward to your books so much. You've got this wonderful series, and the latest one is called Midnight in Europe. Tell us about it.
Basically, it's a book about arms dealing. It takes place in 1938, and it features a lawyer who's at the Coudert International Law Firm in Paris, which was a real law firm, big-time law firm. And it happens at a moment when the Spanish Republic is going down to its defeat because it can't buy arms. The only arms they have are provided by Stalin, and he only does it now and then. It's kind of a very sad war, the Spanish Civil War, and ultimately it was lost. And this is the story of this guy. His name is Christian Farrar, and he gets involved with as a kind of legal consultant to the arms buyers of the Spanish Republic. And they're like, well, the subtitle I've been using for this book is Gangsters versus Fascists, which tells you the whole story.
Would it be appropriate to describe Christian as a Spanish expatriate?
Yes, that's okay. Exactly what he is. He's an emigre. His family had to flee when he was 12 years old, and they fled to Paris, and there they reestablished themselves, his family being his father, mother, and grandmother, and sister.
And you love writing about Paris, don't you?
Oh, man. I sit there at my typewriter, and I start writing about Paris, and right before that, I'm thinking, what am I going to say? What am I going to say? And then when my fingers start hitting the keys, it just happens. I lived there for a long time. It's very much in my heart as a place, and as it was for people in Europe in 1938, and for a long time before that. It was where fugitives went. It was where emigres went. It was where the Poles established a huge presence. It's always been a home to idealists and sensualists and all the best people.
So much of the action in the story revolves around these guys trying to obtain these arms to get them into Spain to somehow keep Franco from winning. Of course, we all know the history. We all know that Franco's going to win and it's hopeless. But still, we have these guys desperately trying to obtain these arms, and there's a lot of traveling involved. And one of the first trips that they make is to Berlin. And this guy that he's traveling with, is it Max DeLeon?
It can be. I think of him as Max DeLeon.
DeLeon.
For whatever reason. I don't think you're supposed to say that, but that's always how I've thought of him.
Okay. I love this Max DeLeon. DeLeon. He's just... You know, Christian is a very cool character, but Max, he's the real deal.
He's the real deal, and he's the star of the book. And sometimes when you're writing a book, that's what happens. Because as a lawyer, Christian Farrar is kind of a straight dude, you know. But he, it's not like he doesn't have a lot of romantic interludes, which I always have in my books. But DeLeon is the character with more interest. He's a guy who was born in a shtetl, in a Jewish ghetto in Russia. And then when he's 12 or so, his mother dies, and he goes and lives on a noble estate in Poland because apparently that's who his father was. He leaves home at, 14 or 15 and survives alone in the world. And for a time is an arms dealer and does a variety of other kind of semi-shady things. And now he finds himself in the arms buying office of the Spanish Republic. He drives a Morgan, by the way, and he likes to go to very, very off-color nightclubs.
Alan First joins us. His latest novel is Midnight in Europe. And the title refers to the fact that we're on the brink. This is 1938. And the big war, World War II, is just around the corner, but first, the Spanish Civil War is coming to a conclusion, and Hitler and his troops are on the move. And as they take the train into Berlin to try to meet an arms dealer, we can see all this ominous, frenzied activity going on, can't we?
Yes. Yeah, I have a scene in there that I like. They're on a train, and they're going through the area, you know, the industrial heartland of Germany, so-called, around Essen, and they see these Krupp factory, and they see these silhouettes against workers silhouetted against the furnace, you know, the blast furnaces, and they're like shadows, but they're running shadows. They're working so hard to build guns and tanks and whatever else it is that they're running. Scary scene in a way, because it's what happened. And nobody, you know, they were doing the best they could in France, but it wasn't very good. They were tied in political knots. They couldn't get it together. And they needed airplanes, which they were never going to get. So it's, you know, kind of a foregone conclusion what's going to happen. It's also a foregone conclusion what's going to happen when Hitler marches into France. And people kind of knew that you couldn't stop him. It was unstoppable. He had all these tanks. He had all these planes. He had very, very committed people who were just crazy to fight a war. And that was not true in France. It was not true in Britain, because World War I had just sucked the core right out of these people.
And Christian has other concerns as well. For one thing, he's got family in France, and he can see what's being built up. And as he's out trying to obtain arms in every possible way to send into Spain, he's seen the dynamic on the continent and what's going on. And he's wondering, should I be concerned about my family in France?
Well, he is concerned, and he knows he's going to have to move them. And there's one scene where he goes to the Coup d'Etat office in New York, and he rents an apartment on the Upper West Side of Manhattan for, I should add, $68 a month, which is the right amount of money for 1938, but it's kind of startling.
Uh-huh. The book is Midnight in Europe. Alan First wrote it. I love the intrigue as they're trying to obtain these arms. First of all, how do they get them? How do they move them into Spain? And then you've got nests of spies who are trying to detect the movement of these arms, because Franco was heavily supported by the fascists in places like Germany and Italy, and the spies are thick on the ground.
Absolutely. And it's kind of just what do I want to call that, an obstacle course, as they try, for example, in the early part of the book, to move guns from the Skoda manufacturer in Brno, Czechoslovakia, up to the Polish port of Gdansk, where they can ship out ultimately to France and then be put on trains and taken down into Spain.
And you've got all that train activity. It's like, where are the arms? Where's the train with the arms? You know,
right.
trying to figure that out.
Right. Well, they try different administrative techniques to stop them. It isn't so much about guys with rifles jumping onto trains. It's more about guys that changed the bills of lading on the car, and they find a way to get the Polish Railway Administration to block the shipment. So the initial attempt by the fascists to stop the arms shipment is technical. You know, they're going to do it so that this train gets lost, or that the train gets blocked, or that the train, you know, a form has to be sent in, and they'll make a decision in a month. It's very, in a way, real life, which is always what I like in my books. I like people to feel that what they're reading about is authentic. That's very important to me, and I think it's very important to my readers. They don't like to be, you know, fooled or anything like that, and they don't like things that are overdone. They like to feel, if I were there, this is exactly what I'd be seeing.
Yes, there are some very real-life scenes, and you always, in these books, we can always expect some some passionate romantic interludes. In fact, I seem to recall in one of your recent books, a moving train was involved.
I like trains. I haven't managed it all that much, but a few times I've been on night trains with a woman friend, and there's something about it that's very special. With all the world going by outside and the sound of the train, especially the sound of a 1938 train, you know, chugga chugga chugga. It appeals to me. Trains appeal to me anyhow. I don't know that I'm the only guy in the world like that, but this is the kind of train where the locomotive's burning coal and you can smell it, you know, in the cars.
And you've got that movement of the train, the rhythmic vibration of the train.
Right,
yeah.
Right, right.
In this one, Christian meets this beautiful Spanish, was she a countess?
Marquesa.
Marquesa, okay. And she's quite an intriguing character.
Well, she certainly was for me. I don't want to give anything away.
Uh-huh.
But she's extremely attractive, somewhat, but not too much, elusive. And it's a portrait of an upper-class aristocrat of the period, very carefully drawn as to what an aristocrat would do and say and look like and wear. I have a woman friend who's in the antique clothing business, or was, and who's fascinated by antique clothing, and she dresses all the women in my books now, and she just does the most incredible things. We had one exchange that went like this. Nylon didn't come in till 1939.
Mm.
So in 1938, as I said to her, well, then she would be wearing black cotton stockings. And she said, yes, that's right. And then there was a beat, and she said, with a seam up the back,
mm-hmm.
Which just killed me. I really like that line. And people like it when I read that section, too, in a bookstore.
And you like to be accurate, don't you?
Oh, yes. Very accurate, as much as I can be. No, I try to make the sex scenes the same, you know, as to what the readers do. You know, it's not like you get books where people do all kinds of acrobatic nonsense, you know, standing up or in the kitchen or whatever. Most people don't do that. So people are like people are, but, you know, they do get excited and good things happen, and it's a very nice part of life.
Alan First joins us. His novel is Midnight in Europe. You started writing books that were set in this period between World War I and World War II. Was Night Soldiers the first one?
Yes, it was. Okay. It was the first one like that.
And I know you had some books before that, but you really hit it. You really hit something when you put out Night Soldiers, didn't you?
Everything changed. Publishers Weekly, when they reviewed Night Soldiers, said, yes, this is the same guy, but the book is completely different than anything he wrote before. So that was, you know, nice of them to say that, and that was absolutely true. But I was, for the first time as a novelist, passionate about something, and that came from an article I wrote for Esquire in 1983, where I intended to just go up the Danube as a travel piece, but the Russians wouldn't let me go to the Russian end of the Danube, which is a small town called Ismailia. They insisted I go to Moscow, so I went to Moscow, just in order that they get these rubles. And I knew the expression police state, but I'd never seen one before. Now, when I went to Moscow, I saw a police state, and that, like, set me on fire. It made me just angry, really. And I have a friend who has a theory that you can't write novels unless you're really angry about something.
Huh. So what is it about this period that not only makes you angry, but is so intriguing to you?
Well, this period is one of the most creative and intense periods that I know about as a decade. It's the worst of people and the best of people. If you look at the films that were made in 1939, it's incredible. I think it's like Stagecoach, The Wizard of Oz, 10 others that you know. If you hear the first four bars of a Glenn Miller song, you're going to know exactly where you are.
Mm.
But equally what's his name? Oh, the guitarist Django Reinhardt.
Uh-huh.
If you hear that, you know where you are. I don't know what it is about the time, but people were very passionate. It's also true that it was a period when a lot of people thought they weren't going to live, so that really colored relationships between lovers during that period. It's just an extraordinary time. Terrible for many people, I emphasize. It's not that I don't know that. But on the other hand, in its way, wonderful for the people who weren't, in the beginning anyhow, like the Jews and others, directly affected. Because a lot of what went on during that period was with emigres, because so many people had been chased out of Germany. They fought in Spain, they went to Paris, they did this, they did that. People were moved around. I don't think they wanted to be, but they were moved around, and they had to start new lives, and that created also a kind of very dynamic situation in the cities where people were.
Alan First joins us. His new novel is Midnight in Europe. A moment ago, you alluded to this trip you made to the Soviet Union back in the early 80s. And earlier in the interview, you mentioned gangsters. And as we get to the climax of your book, one of the most ambitious arms smuggling things that I've ever heard of takes place. And these guys are dealing with this gangster character. What was his name, Slavik?
Something like that.
Okay.
Yes. Very close.
They're dealing with this guy, and they meet up with him in a brothel in Istanbul, and they're trying to steal anti-aircraft guns from a Soviet supply base. I love this.
Well, they first have to figure out where would you find anti-aircraft guns, and especially anti-aircraft ammunition, which they needed because they didn't have fighter planes, so they were going to have to fight the German Air Force from the ground. So we meet a Russian gangster and some of his crew members. He's not a bad Russian gangster. He's just a Russian gangster from Odessa.
And then he tells them, when they're in the brothel, he explains to them why it's so quiet. But the readers will have to discover why.
Yeah, the readers will discover, I'm hoping, interesting things along the way in this novel.
And another great part of it was the Mexican freighter. I love that. The whole intrigue of the smuggling is just so fun to read about because it's so dangerous and thrilling to vicariously experience it as a reader.
Well, I hope so. Do you know what I mean? I write it so that you're on that ship and you're being attacked and various things are happening and it's not clear at all whether they're going to actually make it through. So I'm not going to say that on the radio. Let the reader discover that for him or herself.
Yeah, it's hard not to do spoilers, Alan.
I know. You hear me trying.
I'm trying to be careful here.
Thank you.
Well, all these books, even though they're so closely linked, they really are mostly standalone books, aren't they?
They are standalone books. It's not a series. The lead character, in only one instance in the series, was repeated, and I was sorry I did that.
Uh-huh.
But they are standalone books. You don't have to read anything before anything or after anything. All the books are described on my website, and they're all quite different. They're all in different countries, and they all involve central consciousness characters with different professions. There's a sea captain. There's a couple of journalists. There's a policeman in Salonika. It was all the people who actually participated in the history of this period.
Well, I know from experience and from reading your books, I always look forward to them with great anticipation, and I'm not alone. In fact, a few weeks ago, someone on Facebook in another state who I don't really even know sent me a message and said, "Have you seen the new First yet?"
Oh, great. I love it. That's terrific.
Yeah, and I feel the same way. And then a couple days later, I got the book, and I was so excited. I just started reading it right on the spot. I moved it right to the top of the stack.
Oh, thank you. That is very nice.
So what's the process for you? How do you come up with that little nugget that turns into the next story?
I spend a lot of time reading the political histories of all the countries in Europe. And once I decide on a country, I literally read that 20, 30 times until I learn it, until I really know it. Then, knowing the political history, I start to imagine and sketch out what the secret history might be. And once I have the secret history, then I begin to get my characters. Because I don't write plots in the normal way. My plot is history. So I have to set it up at the right time, because if I'm looking for a climax, it has to be a political, you know, it has to be at a time in the history of that country in the 30s when there was some kind of political climax. It works much better that way for me. A lot of writers don't do that. They write thrillers and which seem to exist outside of time and space, but mine, I'm hoping anyhow, exists very much within time and space, very much within the ordinary chain of events of that period.
Alan First joins us. His latest novel is Midnight in Europe. He's out on a book tour right now, and he joins us by telephone from Chicago. Are you going to be in Winnetka tonight?
I think so. I think the bookstall is in Winnetka.
Okay.
Yes, it is.
Well, I know that you're with Bill Young, so you're in good hands.
Very much in good hands. One of the great people in this business.
And as you're out on tour, I know that can be really exhausting, but what's that like to meet your fans?
It's wonderful. It's not like anything else, and it's been as hard as touring is, and believe me, there's a lot of airplane flights. I'm doing 10 cities. So it's not easy, and it's not easy flying these days anyhow, but reading and then meeting the people who read and like these books is very good for me. It's very good for a writer to know who he's writing for or who reads his work. It changes things, not in a way I could quantify, but once you know that information, you know, everything shifts a little bit left or right. And it happens subconsciously or unconsciously, and that's very good for a writer. Very good for a writer, really it is.
And writing can be such a solitary existence. Well, what a contrast to be out there with all these people.
It is exactly as you say, Vic. It is a huge contrast, because you sit alone in a room for 9 months, and then all of a sudden you're meeting crowds of people.
Do you have input into the covers?
Yes. I mean, I don't have it contractually, but I have worked with the brilliant Random House art department on every cover. They just keep getting better. We started with Brassai photos back in the first books, and my editor at the time called Madame Brassai in Paris and acquired the rights for book covers from Madame Brassai, who simply said, please don't put too much writing on the cover. You know that Brassai was a great Hungarian photographer in Paris in the 1930s. They're wonderful, wonderful photos. If you don't know, maybe go online and look at the pictures or find a way to see them. He had a terrific feel for it, and he was someone who went around at night and photographed prostitutes and pimps and all the people of the night in Paris.
Mm-hmm. This photo on the cover of the new book, what an interesting photo. You've got, obviously, these are French policemen standing in the back, and then you've got this man and woman having an embrace, a kiss, but they're kind of concealed.
Yes, a little bit, yes. No, I like the photo. This one is from an archive because we ran out of the great photographers about 5 books ago. You know, they only made so many images.
Uh-huh.
And the people in the art department at Random House work very, very, very hard on this. They're very proud of it. I don't know that they win prizes, but they win prizes from me, I'll tell you that.
I'm imagining that they actually had a much bigger shot of a crowd scene, and then they zeroed in on this particular aspect of the photo.
I expect you're absolutely right. I expect you're absolutely right, because the photo continues over onto the back cover.
Okay. Alan First joins us. His new one is Midnight in Europe. And knowing how the publishing industry works, I'm guessing that you probably have already written the next book.
No.
Okay.
I start the next book in September. Oh, I should add something that I found out a couple of days ago, is that Midnight in Europe debuts in the New York Times Book Review at number 6 on the bestseller list this Sunday.
I'm sorry.
Had to get that in, you know?
Oh, wow. That's exciting, isn't it?
Yeah, it's cool. Yeah,
wow.
No, it makes you feel good.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Alan First has been our guest on the program, and it's been a while. I'm trying to remember the last time we had you on when you came out. I'm trying to remember which book it was, because I've read every single book you've put out since then, but I'm blanking on which book it would have been. I think it was probably in the late 90s. Does that sound right?
It could well be, but, you know, when you've done 13 books, it's very hard to fix them in time. And when you have to fix them in time and come up with a geographical location, it's impossible. In other words, where was I or where did I tour for this particular book?
Well, since I don't remember, I certainly don't expect you to.
Okay.
And I imagine if we were to look into your writer's lair somewhere around, where do you live, Long Island?
Long Island, okay. Sag Harbor, Long Island.
I bet you there's a great big stack of books there for your research for the next one.
Just building that stack, because I've been very busy doing pre-production and publicity for Midnight in Europe, but I have some books in my library. They're not in the stack yet, but, you know, I've got them pulled out so that they have a profile on the shelf.
Uh-huh.
And I'm ready to go around and pull those out and make a pile and start reading.
Well, we really appreciate your time today.
My pleasure.
My guest has been Alan First. His latest is Midnight in Europe. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McKeonis. Fourteen years ago, I interviewed a writer from France on this program. His name is Marc Levy. He had written a novel that had just been translated into English, and that book eventually became a major Hollywood motion picture. Well, I never have talked to him since. So we had to do something about that. He's got a new novel out. It's called Replay. And we're going to have Marc Levy back on the program next week. He's written 14 books in 14 years. And this one is a real thriller. A man is murdered at the beginning. And then he goes back in time and gets to replay his life all over again. You'll hear about it in the Book Nook next week. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.